Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. Ross tells us the volatility on the stock exchanges made it a bad week to be a short-term trader, and the value of the U.S. dollar continues to climb. Founder of Armstrong Economics, Martin Armstrong, talks about the upcoming panic cycle, with the Bank of England already going into panic mode. He also talks about what he believes is driving sky-high inflation. Longtime BC broker Victor Adair weighs in on the cost of living, gold, and where we go with increasing interest rates. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Introducing Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB, AMYZF, and Frankfurt 2AM. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on Twitter at ChartsByRoss. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Good to be with you, Jim.
Ross, this was probably not the best week to be a short-term trader.
No, you had to, every time something got out of hand, one way or the other, you really had to have the fortitude to either ride it out or take advantage of the swings. I mean, as somebody who lives on the West Coast, I decided that I would get up just in time to find out the CPI number on Thursday, and there's the market down 300 points. So I thought, okay, I'll go back and have another hour's worth of sleep, which I did, and the market was up 350 points. So unless you are very nimble, and nimble in the correct way, it's not the type of market you want to be playing with. And, you know, this has really just been in a consolidation phase since the hard break off the August highs. And the modeling, you know, we take a look at these rolling tops. You know, we've got, you know, maybe seven or eight of them since the 1929 top, where the market has rolled over and then had the just a grinding bear market where you get the good hard break, you get a quick short covering rally, get overbought, and then slide again. And this, in terms of where we are right now, still looking for the upside, maybe a 38% to 50% retracement from the August high. If we spend our time just consolidating in here the way it seems to be, then, the 100-day moving average is what we're looking at as resistance. And that, when we look back at all these other bear markets off of rolling tops, that would be the classic resistance right now. So, you know, give it, maybe another 2 or 3 weeks sitting around in this zone, and, we'll probably, vulnerable to another break from the downside. But at this point, the day-to-day stuff is really something to stay away from, and especially if you've got pending news that the market is looking for, like the CPI, then, you know, why not enjoy the day that we've got here?
Is the main story out there when it comes to increasing value the U.S. dollar?
Oh, definitely. You know, this is the post-bubble environment that we're in. The U.S. dollar historically is, you know, where people tend to put their money. And this, you know, the dollar index, every time it pokes its head up a little bit, then there's a vulnerability across the board, most of the other items. You know, and in this last, you know, look at the last month. We were up around 115 about 2 or 3 weeks ago. On the dollar index, it corrected down to 110, so pretty significant break. Got a nice rally in virtually everything, in commodity-wise, stock market. And then this last week, We had been working our way slowly up, and Friday was a nice good day on the dollar. It's back retesting the highs. We're around 113 and a quarter. And with that, you know, you got pretty much red across the board on just about everything else as this dollar is just grinding its way up. We've got the type of overbought signals that you expect to see as you're getting into a high. But clearly, you have to wait until a momentum is lost here on the upside. And you need a week with a lower close to show that that momentum is dissipated. And I wouldn't be in a rush to look at fading that market. The corrections could be pretty deep, but unless you're nimble, I don't think that it's worth trying to play the opposite side of this one right now.
How's the Canadian dollar doing?
72 and change, and this is, doing what we would normally expect as a commodity-based currency. The commodities as a whole, you take a look at base metals, precious metals, and then over into the crude oil market, everything sort of petered out here for the Canadian dollar, petered out around 74 10 days ago, and we're just under 72, just looking at it, the close on Friday, and there's some signals here. We've got a sequential 9, so we've had on the weekly chart, we've had 9 consecutive weeks with closes below 4 weeks earlier. The last couple of times we saw this was at interim lows. We had one back March of a year ago, that infamous one where everything broke with COVID. That was a good low. You had one back in December of 18. Just looking at the graphic here, there are some really nice interim lows. So I would say that for all that the trend is down, you might look for a bounce back, maybe to around 74.5 on the Canadian dollar.
Crude, how's that doing?
Crude oil had a really good rally into the early part of the week, and we've got resistance levels here that we've been looking at, some moving averages, and in particular, a Bollinger Band. And that one, the targeted resistance for that was just shy of 94, and that's where we traded up to. The strength then in the dollar is, it's done well in the last 3 or 4 days. This caused weakness in the oil market. We're back down to 85 and change. Now, this rally that we've had off of the late September low at 76 and a quarter, we should not be giving back more than 50 to 60% of that to have the potential for upside action in here. So the rally to the 94 level was pretty much on track. The pullback here is on track. What happens going forward will really be important, because if we can't hold 84, call it an $84 level, 50% of the rally, then the bullish scenario that we have in terms of a pattern would be negated, and be looking for a whole new leg to the downside. So we're going to let the market show us what it wants to do. The move from, say, from 94 down to 85 and change here is normal, and let's see what it does pushing forward.
Anything happening with gold?
Gold is having a tough week. The gold market itself, if you take a look at the futures contract, closed off the week at 1649, and this is down from 1740 just a matter of 10 days ago. So once again, strength in the dollar causing trouble. We're giving back enough gear that I think you're going to be looking probably at a violation of the $1,600 level before it finds the next important low. And most of the lows in gold give us some pretty strong signals. And when they are simultaneously hit with the silver market, then we can get some good interim lows, some good tradable lows. The last one having been at the end of September, and we ended up rallying from sort of the 1650-ish level up to 1740. So that was a nice rally for the traders. We'll look for the next good oversold, but as I say, that's probably under 1600, before we could be looking at something that is down hard enough to give us a viable entry point.
Ross, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Pleasure to be with you, Jim.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. You can find him on Twitter at ChartsByRoss. Coming up, Martin Armstrong next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. This Week in Money is archived online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Martin Armstrong, founder of Armstrong Economics, available online at ArmstrongEconomics.com. He's speaking to us from beautiful, freedom-filled Florida. Marty, welcome back to This Week in Money.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
Your World Economic Conference is coming up November 11th through the 13th. What can you tell us about it?
Well, we're going to be really covering all the countries. I mean, the entire world is just in complete chaos at this stage. Honestly, in the 40 years of I've been dealing with governments, I've never seen the worst crop of heads of state around the world ever. I mean, there's nobody you can even rely on that has any understanding of what's going on or any expertise. I mean, they all seem to be just cheering, you know, World War III. It's amazing, but I mean, basically we're going to be looking at all the markets from Asia, Europe, North America, and see what larger the computer is projecting out. It's next year looks to be really just a tremendous upheaval and civil unrest, and even geopolitical levels. Even Henry Kissinger basically said he's been called by every president who has come to the White House except for Biden. It is amazing. It is absolutely amazing.
Where is the conference and how can people sign up for it?
Well, they can go to our website. You can attend virtually or fly in for it. It will be held in Orlando. I think it's, I'm not sure which the hotel is. I think it's the Marriott that we use there. Mm-hmm.
You're working on a new book. What can you tell us about it?
Basically this is I got a hold of all the declassified documents from the Clinton administration. And what I had originally said in the Forecaster movie back in 2014 was that, you know, it was basically a plot to take over Russia. And what's really come out from all the documents, and most people wouldn't realize, but when Russia collapsed in 1991, NATO actually went to them and said, offered, you know, Russia to join. And that's what sparked the coup against Gorbachev. The hardliners, you know, the old communists basically, tried seizing the government because they saw that as Russia surrendering to the United States. And, that's when Yeltsin stood on the tank and the coup was defeated. It was a real interesting period in history, but that's what actually sparked it. It was originally this plot to, offer Russia to join NATO, and then when that failed, then they got involved with Berezovsky and a bunch of oligarchs to try and do it.
Tulsi Gabbard is making news. Rumors she would make a great running mate for President Trump. What are you hearing about Tulsi?
I think she is actually probably has more intelligence than most of the people that seem to be out there right now. She's basically saying that she's more or less an independent. And everything she said about the Democratic Party is really true in spades. People don't understand that those in power, they only look for whatever is immediately in front of their nose. They don't look at the long-term effects of what they actually do. I had actually the mandate from Hong Kong to negotiate with the Australian government when, Hong Kong was going to be handed back to China. And I met with Paul Keating, who is basically ended up being the prime minister there. And I said, look, I've got a blank check. I can pay off your national debt. And everything I tried, the answer was no. And I finally asked him, I said, what is this racist or something? I really couldn't come up with an explanation. And he said, no. He said they would vote conservative, and he was in the Labor government. So they wouldn't allow them in to Australia simply because they were afraid that they would change the demographics politically. This is what the Biden administration is doing right now, and that's why they have the borders open, taking in all these people, because they assume they're going to vote for Democrat. Now, take Ukraine, for example. If you Ukrainian hops on a plane and flies to the United States directly, they're returned. All right? So they said, okay, fine, they can fly to Mexico. And then the Homeland Security just issued an order saying that if Ukrainians come in through the Mexican border, they should be accepted. And everybody else has to have a vaccination. Anybody from South America coming in, you could have the black flag. It doesn't matter. So it's all political. It's constantly political, and they're trying to do the same thing I encountered in Australia. They're hoping to allow so many people in that this is how the Democrats will win.
The U.S. midterms are less than a month away. Could we see unrest in the U.S. as the midterms approach?
Yes. I mean, our computer is basically showing very significant civil unrest, particularly in 23. I don't think it matters even who wins because either side is not going to accept it. It's just they have polarized the country to such an extent that it's the other side is just it's like foreigners and being invaded by a foreign entity. I mean, the Democrats hate Republicans and the Republicans hate the Democrats, and it's just no resolution.
Does it look like Hurricane Ian that just hit Florida could have been man-made through geoengineering?
I don't think so. I haven't really looked at that in depth, but I mean, that one was a little unusual in the sense that it started right there on the coast of Mexico. Usually they start off in Africa and come across the Atlantic. And the only one that ever hit Tampa actually was in the Pacific across Mexico and then came straight in. But these people are always trying to blame everything on climate change. And no matter what it is, oh, it's because we have CO2 or some other nonsense. But, if you just look at history, according to these people, I guess the last ice age turned warm because people were driving their SUVs around.
Wouldn't more CO2 mean better crops?
Yeah, I mean, trees, I mean, plants, that's what they live off of, CO2. I mean, I don't know. I mean, this is a theory that somebody put out, and it's just a theory. It's been absolutely no proof of anything. You know, you look at earthquakes and fires in California and Australia. I mean, you know, the same thing here in the Gulf of Mexico. There was a red tide, and immediately they blame the farmers. Oh, it's the chemicals from farmers. Well, I just put into Google, and I, you know, to Google what was the first known red tide. It was 1642, recorded by the Spanish. I don't think there were any farmers here, and they certainly weren't using chemicals.
Could Russia-Ukraine be the beginning of World War III?
Oh, yes, very much so. our computer had been warned about that in 2013. And, I mean, this is it. This is a proxy war of the West against Russia. And a lot of it is actually what they will, you know, admit publicly, but it's because of climate change. 50% of Russia's GDP is production of energy. And, you know, they have been wanting to shut that down. And, immediately when the pipeline was blown up, you had Blinken come in, oh, this is an extraordinary opportunity. Then he, you know, oh, well, I didn't mean it that way. but that's all they've ever been doing is just trying to shut down all, energy production. You know, Saudi Arabia just came out and admitted that Biden went to them and said, please don't reduce production until after our elections. I mean, they don't care about the country. They don't care about the people, anything. And, I mean, Putin did not invade Ukraine. All right, if he was trying to invade Ukraine and conquer it, the first thing you do is you take out the power grid, you take out all the communications, then you take out the water supply. That's what we did to Iraq. I mean, that is standard military practice. And my concern is if you put everybody on electric cars and digital currency, and we go to war and they take out the power grid, what's going to happen? I mean, the entire country will be completely paralyzed.
It looks like most, if not all, world leaders in NATO have connections to Klaus Schwab's World Economic Forum Agenda 2030, the Great Reset, where you will own nothing and be happy about it. Are they trying to force Russia to join NATO?
No, I think they basically they want to dismantle Russia, actually. And they've had this stupid theory that, like when they went in the Middle East, so if they take out these dictators, the people will rejoice and they'll get like a ticker tape parade. And that's just not the case. It didn't work anywhere in the Middle East, and they think the same thing about Russia. Oh, we take down Putin, and the people will cheer us. And that's not going to happen. You know, they have created such hatred against Russians in general. It's outrageous. I mean, even Czechoslovakia is saying, you know, confiscate all the assets of any Russian, and if they want them back, they have to prove they don't support Putin. I mean, it's nuts, completely nuts. And, this is the way they create war. They did the same thing against the Japanese, and that's why all the Japanese were imprisoned during World War II. They demonize the head of a state, and then it gradually applies to everybody that's of that country.
World leaders have been sending billions of dollars to Ukraine. Could this be a money laundering operation for the globalists paid for by taxpayers?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I have confirmation from Congress that they have absolutely confirmed that Zelensky has stashed at least $100 million offshore. Other reports are saying now it's up to $850 million. Ukraine, I know very well. I have friends on all sides over there. Ukraine is historically the most corrupt country in Europe, if not the world. There's nothing that you can ever listen to from Ukraine even before this war, that would be truthful. I mean, that's why the whole Biden administration and all the kickbacks and everything with Ukraine, that's the standard operational procedure over there.
Has worldwide election fraud put illegitimate leaders in power at the country, state, province, and city levels?
Well, it's kind of like Stalin basically said. He said that doesn't matter who votes, it's who counts the votes that matters. And this is the problem. I don't think that, you know, all these things are getting to be very dramatic. I mean, even with rigging the elections, Biden won only 1.3% of a majority. And then they use that to oppress the complete, you know, the other half of the country. This is not what democracy was about. In fact, that is why many of the Greek philosophers were against democracy, because they felt that it was the way for a majority to basically oppress the minority. And I have to agree. I mean, Biden shouldn't be able to do this, or Trudeau. It should require at least a two-thirds vote to make any dramatic changes like this. I mean, you can't say, well, I've got 51.3%, so that's a majority, and I can completely change everything in the country. It's absurd.
Are politics destroying markets and economies by design?
Well, this whole thing with Klaus Schwab, and when he's really saying you'll own nothing and be happy, he's trying to make it sound like they're going to default for your benefit, and it's not. Governments have been borrowing since World War II with a deficit every single year. There is absolutely zero chance of them ever paying back anything, and they never intend to anyhow. The worst thing is, and you're beginning to see it in Europe, when they put interest rates at negative in 2014, but then they had these laws where, oh, we have to be concerned, and pension funds had to own, depending upon where you were, anywhere between 70% to 90% government bonds. So then you take the government interest rate to negative. They have wiped out pension funds. I mean, this is why, you know, you have the Bank of England over there in a panic mode. People are just dumping bonds, and the pension funds have lost a fortune. So, I mean, this is why you're looking at also them coming up and saying that, there'll be guaranteed basic income, because that's to replace all the pensions that they've wiped out. But, you know, government is going to default. And this goes back to this war with Ukraine, because they actually think that if they create a war, that will be the justification to default on the debts, as it was after World War II. And what they will do then is create Bretton Woods, you know, version 2. And they want to create a new digital currency. And that's basically what they have in mind.
What are the pitfalls of going to digital currency?
Basically, the problem is that it makes the entire power grid the number one target in a war, or even terrorism. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, without any physical money, and the stores are down or whatever, I mean, that's it. I mean, we've had hurricanes here in Florida, and, you know, the electric's down, that you can't go to the bank, get anything out. So most people go to the bank down here, and they get a few thousand dollars in cash, and they keep it on hand. Because they know, in a hurricane, you can't go to the bank.
Yeah, the gas pumps don't work either, because there's no electricity.
Exactly. Yeah. So what you have is also, when they're going to say a hurricane's coming, you see the lines at gas stations, and everybody fills everything up to the absolute max.
Could we be witnessing the end of globalization?
Yes, I mean, that's what's basically taken place, largely because the sanctions against Russia. it's one thing for one country to sanction another country. But when it was extended to, they claimed, oh, Russian oligarchs are really supporting Putin or whatever, that was a violation of international law. Because now all of a sudden it's like, why should somebody from China actually have anything invested in another country? If that country gets in an argument with China, then, oh, well, we'll just confiscate all assets that belong to Chinese. It's just absurd. That violates the very foundation of globalization. That there has to be a rule of law, and if there's a rule of law and you can buy property in China or anywhere else, and there's a court that validates, okay, fine, see, I have the mortgage. And it's recognized. Once you no longer recognize that, globalization cannot exist.
Is Socrates expecting any panic cycles between now and the end of the year, and what exactly is Socrates?
Well, Socrates is basically, it's the only real fully functioning artificial intelligence system in the world, actually. It writes itself over 1,000 forecasting reports on instruments around the world every day. There's no human interaction to it, so it's objective. And it basically looks at everything and correlates the entire world. And I notice these things. I grew up as a programmer, and as a hedge fund manager, I saw how capital moves. In the 80s, it was in Geneva, and we were dealing with all the OPEC money back then. And then, Japan was rising. And the talent and the money all went to Japan. And then you got the big bubble there at that point in time, in 1989. And then the capital went, oh, okay, what's next? Oh, Southeast Asia. Boom. Everybody went down there. That peaked out in 1994. Then it's like, oh, okay, fine. Let's go to Russia. All right. That blew up in 98. And, oh, the euro is coming. And it's like a pack of wolves that runs around, and they're all in the same trade. When Greece, defaulted in 2010, the first thing, everybody, they were shorting that, and they go, oh, who's next? Oh, Spain. Yeah, let's go get Spain. And then it was Italy. This is the way capital moves. I suggest you can find on the internet Herbert Hoover's memoirs. And I suggest you read 1931. And he's talking about the sovereign defaults then. He said, capital acted like a loose cannon on the deck of a ship in the middle of a hurricane. He said, it was shooting off in every which direction so fast they couldn't even form a committee to figure out where it was going. And that's exactly what happens in a panic. And money is rushing around the world. And this is the problem. This is why the dollar is rising right now. You create war in Europe with Ukraine, and the capital moves to North America. That's, U.S. was bankrupt in 1896, and was World War One, then World War Two that made it the financial capital of the world, because all the money left Europe and came here. If tanks are running down the street, blowing up everything, I don't think you're going to leave your money there in a local bank.
So do you expect any panic cycles between now and the end of the year?
Yeah, mostly it is targeting the first week of November, November 7th, which seems to be a crossroads between also Ukrainian problems with the war over there, in addition to the U.S. election, which, I objectively, the Republicans should at least take the House. They may even take the Senate. That's still a little bit of a coin toss. But regardless, neither side's going to accept whatever the outcome is. So the Democrats will be calling it a rigged election, or the Republicans will be calling it. So, this is what we're heading into.
Do you think inflation and rising interest rates are by design to destroy the middle class?
No, I mean, I think that maybe gives these politicians a little too much credit. The inflation was set in motion because of their absurd response to COVID. Locking people down and stuff like that, you basically wiped out the supply chain. I had ordered a refrigerator, and it was like they said, look, it's going to be probably 9 months before it shows up. I said, what's the problem? They said, well, the chips come from Thailand, and there's no ships from Thailand. So, I mean, I don't know if these people, I mean, I've never, like I said, in the 40 years I've been dealing with governments, they're not that smart. And I seriously doubt that they even understood what they were doing. It was just all about, let's, you know, they were paid bribes, I think, by Pfizer. I think that came out down in Australia. And now, you know, Pfizer's, you know, it's getting out that Pfizer never even really bothered testing a lot of this stuff. And everybody that I know that got, you know, was seriously ill were the ones that got vaccinated. I even went to go get my hair cut, and the two women there in the shop both lost their son-in-laws. One was like 25, one was like 27 after they got vaccinated. So, I mean, it's, you know, there are people that, you know, can't get any kind of a vaccination, and others can. So, I mean, we're all different. You know, and to say that everybody absolutely has to have the same thing is ridiculous, because, you know, we're not all, you know, made the same way. We have different gene pools, et cetera, and some people are susceptible to things and others are not. So it's not that everybody that gets vaccinated would die. I mean, but some will. I mean, that's just the way it is. I mean, a guy that works for me, his entire family can't even take a flu shot.
President Trump recently predicted interest rates heading back towards 21% last hit in the early 80s. What does Socrates see ahead for interest rates?
I don't see them going that high, but interest rates are definitely going up into 2024. This inflation, you have to understand that the inflation rate will continue higher, and no raising of interest rates by central bank is going to stop it. In fact, it will only accelerate, because this kind of inflation is different. This is based on shortages. This is not a speculative boom that, oh, if we raise interest rates and the speculators will cost too much, so they won't continue to buy. That's not the case. There's just shortages. There's sometimes I go to the store, there's absolutely no eggs. Then I've never seen that. And then, you know, a few days later, they're back. I mean, these things have just never happened before. And you have to understand that the inflation is what's causing the civil unrest primarily at this stage in the game outside of North America. Because third world countries, they don't have the social structure, the unemployment benefits and things of this nature, and you start taking fuel prices and you drive them up crazy and people can't even feed their kids. So you're seeing civil unrest in a lot of places, you know, from Sri Lanka and Africa and Middle East, and I mean, it's all over. So the poorer the country, the worse it's going to get.
The U.S. dollar's been hitting new highs. Does Socrates have near-term and long-term targets for the greenback?
Yeah, I mean, the dollar will basically is in a bull market at least for 2024. I mean, there'll be oscillations back and forth, but again, what you're looking at is capital is concentrating over here because of all the chaos in Europe. Europe looks to be an absolute basket case, and the economics are terrible. You then have war on their horizon over there as well, and I seriously doubt you're going to see Europe even survive, the EU survive. I mean, you're seeing in Poland, Hungary, and Italy, people are starting to wake up and say, "Hey, this, you know, one size fits all doesn't work.
Is the U.S. dollar losing its reserve currency status to other fiat currencies?
No, not yet. The you know, people, I think, tend to get all enamored over, oh, well, if it's got to be gold or something like that. And that's just simply not true. It doesn't matter what people use for currency. I mean, everything from clamshells to cattle and if you read St. Patrick, the standard value of wealth in Ireland at the time was slave girls. So it's been everything under the sun. And the main thing is that whatever somebody else is willing to accept, that's okay. So, you know, as long as you know you can take it in a dollar and somebody else will take it from you, it's all right. It's when nobody else will take it, then you're not going to accept a dollar yourself. So we're not at that stage yet. I mean, eventually what happens is that you're going to see the defaults happen in Europe from the governments there in debt. That will send capital over to primarily to the United States. And then eventually they're going to say, well, everybody else has had these problems. The U.S. is going to be next. So then most likely what you're going to see is a massive flight of capital from government bonds into private sector assets. And that will be a resurgence in some equities as well as real estate and precious metals.
You mentioned the European Union is likely to break up. What would the economic consequences of that be?
Largely that they're going to have to revert back to their own currencies. When they were forming the EU, they actually came to me and I warned them that this is not going to work unless you consolidate the debts. And at the time, Kohl was chancellor in Germany, and he knew if he submitted it to a vote in Germany, he would have lost. He said he would have lost 7-1. So he admitted he acted like a dictator, and he just put Germany into the euro and never allowed anybody to vote on it. So his main thing was that they would not accept a consolidation of the debt because then that would be like bailing out Italy and Greece, etc. So the euro design was incorrect. They were pitching it like a single currency will all pay the same interest rate like in the United States. And I warned them that is not the case. You're comparing the federal rate. Whereas if you do not consolidate the debts, then you're going to have Europe, like the United States, with 50 different states. And they all pay different interest rates based upon their creditworthiness. And I warned them that was going to happen in Europe. And they told me, yes, okay, fine, we understand, but we just have to do it this way because we have to get the euro in first. Then we'll worry about the debt later. And here we are, you know, they... Well, it's 30 years later, and they have not ever addressed the debt issue.
Could the U.S. and Canada break up, and how could the breakup map look?
Yes, you're seeing this polarization. And in Canada, it tends to be west versus the east. In United States, it was originally north versus south, but at that time, California, et cetera, wasn't a state. So it's more going to be like the south through the Midwest, even up into Alberta, would be more or less one philosophical idea against the north, you know, New England area and California. I mean, California is just, it's like a foreign country.
Would you see BC, Washington, Oregon, and California forming a country?
Yes, I mean those three of them are just, you know, they're out of their minds actually, but they're completely fiscally irresponsible. Their ideas that they have pushed are extremely one-sided. I mean, it's, like I said, this is what the Greek philosophers warned about. You know, civilization is when everybody comes together and we all benefit. When you start dividing it and one group against the other group, it no longer works. And that's why you have civil wars, etc. I mean, you know, this idea of one country, yeah, okay, fine. The Roman Empire lasted for 1,000 years, but it also went through a lot of civil wars.
Real estate sales are dropping off a cliff. Is there a time lag before prices drop, and how far could they drop in the U.S. and Canada?
Oh, well, it depends where you're at. I mean, you look at the highest taxed and regulated cities, that's where people are fleeing from. So, for example, we still see an awful lot of people from California, New York, Connecticut, New Jersey, moving more towards like Texas and Florida. So you don't see the prices declining very much in this area. And also what you see here, which is interesting, is that the higher priced houses, you know, 1.5 million and up, are selling for cash. So that's people basically just getting money out of the, you know, off the grid, and they're getting it away from banks, etc., and putting it wherever, you know, it's something that's more tangible.
What's the latest on the economic confidence index?
Just basically further declining. I think a lot of people beginning to see this is the early stages of an economic nightmare, I would say. You're going to see it more next year. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, we just have the worst possible crop of world leaders ever. And, you know, a lot of them are, you know, on the leash from Klaus Schwab. And I know Klaus, he's a communist. What else can I say? I mean, he believes that government can control everything. And that's his agenda. Marcus Vetter, who did the film on me, the forecaster, he also did the film on Schwab, you know, called The Forum. And, you know, I've talked to Marcus, and he's, like, thoroughly disgusted with what's going on at the World Economic Forum anymore.
Automakers are focusing more and more on the production of electric vehicles. Is this likely to increase the demand for battery metals and electricity?
Yes. I mean, it's something that people just say, oh, yes, okay, fine, that sounds great. And they don't look at the long term. Even the most conservative forecast that I have seen, that the power grid would have to increase by 400%, and that's the minimum if we're looking at putting just all cars on electric. I mean, California, they were saying, you know, we're, you know, the power grid's under stress, so please don't use air conditioning. In Europe, you're finding, you know, passing laws that you can be fined if you are using heat above a certain temperature. I mean, it's just, you know, we don't have an alternative in place for fossil fuels. It's simple as that. But these people that are running government, which has become more of like an insane asylum, but their view is, well, we don't care about the alternatives. Let's just shut everything down now, because they're worried that the other side will get back in power. And so they want to destroy the production as much as possible. So if that happens, the other side won't have the ability to rebuild it. And this is just a war on fossil fuels. And as I said, this is what's even behind, you know, the whole war with Russia.
Has crude oil likely already seen its highs for this cycle?
No, we're going to be looking at higher prices next year.
Is it possible gas prices are being manipulated higher to entice people to buy electric cars?
I wouldn't say that it's a lot, but you know, the government would certainly like to have the gasoline prices higher. They do this in, they think that if the price is high, then people will buy the electric cars. But I can tell you right here, you know, in Florida, if there's a hurricane coming, how far are you going to get with a hurricane, you know, out of the state or something out of the way with an electric car?
Are electric vehicles, smart meters, digital ID, digital currencies, components of control to enslave people?
More or less. I mean, I don't really think that they envision it as enslavement. But for years, all I've ever heard is that government would not have a problem if everybody paid their taxes. So this idea of moving to a digital currency is that if you pay a 14-year-old girl next door to watch your kids, you know, how are you going to pay her, all right? She'd have to be taxed. You can't give her cash anymore. I mean, that's what they look at. Everything is, where's our cut of this? You found a $100 bill in the parking lot, where's our 50%? So moving to digital, they think they're eliminating the underground economy, and they just, you know, lick their lips over this. I mean, it's a very dangerous proposition, but again, they do not consider the welfare of the nation. They only look at themselves and only what's immediately in front of their nose.
Does Socrates see a double bottom or a continued drop here for the stock markets? And what does Socrates see for the stock markets heading into the new year?
Well, you're still going to see the retail side of the stock market decline. But if you look at it, like the Dow Jones has been holding up more than the NASDAQ. And that's because eventually the real problem here is that governments are going to default, basically. So you're having people, the big money, it's in pension funds, et cetera, they've been bailing out. I mean, just like in Britain, they've been bailing out, and where are you going to go? You know, you're looking at about $50 to $60 trillion in debt just in the United States. I mean, if you eliminated government debt, and you know, the stock market would be at least double. So it's amount of money coming out of the official bond markets that will eventually move into the equities and tangible markets. But I would expect that probably more from January of next year.
Does Socrates see an end to the manipulation of agriculture and food supplies?
Not really. I mean, those in government are always going to constantly be playing around with this. They don't understand what they're doing at all. Once again, it's what do I need for the soundbite for tonight's show? That's about it.
Do you think the climate change narrative is a crime against humanity?
Absolutely. There's just there's no proof whatsoever that fossil fuels has changed the climate. I mean, we were in the middle of the Little Ice Age that bottomed in the late 1600s, and all their data goes back from 1850. Say, oh, see, the warming period was all because of Industrial Revolution, and that's absolute nonsense. You know, you can look at all the data on weather going back hundreds of thousands of years. There's been cycles up and cycles down. You know, and even the sun does not put out the same amount of energy all the time. It pulsates like your heart. And they ignore all of this and want to always reduce everything to a single cause and effect, and it's always us. Like I said, down here in Florida, they talked about the red tide in the Gulf of Mexico. And immediately they wanted to say, oh, it's farmers and chemicals. And like I said, you know, you can Google it. The first one I saw was 1642.
Well, it was much warmer during Roman times. We're finding Roman artifacts under retreating glaciers. So what caused all the warming back then?
Exactly. I mean, yeah. The Roman Empire expanded because of the warming period. All right. When you go into these cold periods, the civilization declines, mainly because you cannot even grow food. John Adams, in one of his letters, is talking about, you know, during the American Revolution, that it was so cold that the ground was frozen 2 feet down and couldn't even plant anything. You can also Google it and find out, you know, how many people died in Valley Forge under George Washington's army because it was so cold. We've just been going through a natural warming period, then it will turn cold again and start moving back down.
Death rates are increasing substantially. What effects could this have on markets, economies, and daily life?
Well, you know, I mean, everything has an impact. And it doesn't, you know, come down to a single cause and effect. It is everything combined. So, you know, we're just going to be looking at rising civil unrest, because mainly because inflation is going to continue to go up, and that's going to hurt the people, the lower classes in North America, but it's going to hurt people outside North America in the emerging markets tremendously. And as interest rates rise, you're also undermining all the emerging market debt. So a lot of the emerging markets issued debt in dollars. That was part of the problem in China, that China had warned its provinces and banks not to borrow in dollars, and they didn't listen. They borrowed in dollars because they thought they were saving money on interest rates. Well, the dollar went up about 25%, and now everybody's, you know, they're losing their shirt. But I've seen that same pattern over and over and over again. In the 80s, it was Australia. The bankers sold Swiss loans down there. The Swiss franc went up, and a lot of people lost their houses. They did the same thing with the Swiss peg to the euro. And when that broke, the same thing. They were selling all Swiss franc loans, because you'll save interest rates, and then all of a sudden people lost 20% of their houses. Everything has a cycle to it. Nothing remains constant forever. The same way as we all get old, we get frail, and then we die. Everything absolutely has a cycle to it. And ignoring these cycles is a recipe for disaster. And that's why also the climate change people are causing tremendous problems, because they are just ignoring that there is a natural cycle.
Could increased death rates be by design to avert the upcoming pension crisis?
Well, I mean, the pension crisis that we have is mainly because a lot of them are restricted by law and have to have government debt. I mean, U.S. Social Security is 100% government debt. And back in the 90s, I was called in and to set up a system to convert it to a wealth fund where we start buying equities and things. And the Democrats wouldn't vote for it. And I spent a lot of time on it, and I said, this is how we do it. And people will then submit their track records, and we hand it out according to the best track record. And they said they wanted to be able to change the fund managers if they got back in power. And I said, I don't care who the person voted for. It's, did he do a good job? Yes or no? Maybe he didn't even vote. I don't care. They would not accept it. That's what I say about politicians. They're always about, what do I get out of this? It's a complete disaster, the political systems that we have, and I think they're all going to go belly up. And the real thing is, after 2032, we're going to have to decide what kind of a government do we really want.
Wasn't it Churchill who said democracy is a horrible system of government, but so far nobody's invented anything better? What's better than democracy?
The problem that we have with it is that we really have republics, and it's not really democracy. Democracy is where, okay, fine, are we going to, do you want to invade, Ukraine, and everybody votes from home, okay? We don't get to do that. Politicians are the ones that make war. Soldiers, the best they can possibly hope for is that they come home, unharmed. That's it. What do they get out of it? Nothing. Nobody wins other than politicians. And the idea of a republic that the founding fathers in the United States had sounded good. The terms were 2 years. That was fine. But what they failed to do was put term limits in, because people also weren't paid. So they, it was kind of like, I did my 2 years. I donated my time to the country, going to war or something. And sure, that was a good person. Once they start paying themselves, then they turned it into basically a one-armed bandit, and they just kept making money and using inside information and everything else. I mean, career politicians are the worst possible thing, because they are always on that side. They always look at us as the opponent, and the best form of government I ever saw in all my research was the city of Genoa in Italy. There were all the wealthiest families ruled. However, the post rotated for like the Doge or like the president every year. So one family would be in charge, and then basically it might be 30 years by the time it gets back to that family again. So consequently, nobody would ever pass a law that they would have to be subjected to themselves the following year. So Genoa was used more or less like a corporation. It competed against Florence and Venice. So everybody benefited. Income tax makes no sense. It was outlawed by the founding fathers of the United States, no direct taxation. And this is all Marxist stuff. And then the government has to know everything you're doing. Did you find a $100 bill laying in a parking lot? Whereas indirect taxation should be it, period, a sales tax. That's it. And you shouldn't have to report on absolutely everything you do. Did I give my son $5,000, or whatever? I mean, it's absurd. It's very intrusive, and it doesn't further the state. And the more money they get, they only spend more. That's why they're always in perpetual deficits. And it's always, we are the problem, and how much can we get out of this? And so the best form of government, to me, is at least, if we're going to do a republic, then it cannot be any career politicians. The idea that it was 2 years in Congress, they also only met for 6 weeks out of the year. That should be it. And you do it one term and out. Done.
Do you have any plans to get an electric vehicle?
No, I have a hybrid. The hybrid is fine. I have a BMW i8, which recharges the electric. It has two engines, a gas engine and an electric engine, and I've never had to plug it in. Driving around, and it automatically charges the batteries.
And, of course, you look for hills to charge it up too, I bet.
Well, don't even have to. It's got fantastic brakes. Okay. The brakes are much better than any other car, because the brakes are used to create the electricity.
What are the biggest wins you've had in the markets?
Recently, I guess everybody says the dollar. And I guess the stock market, the second one. But I mean, I get tons of emails from overseas, like, thank you so much for the, you know, your forecast on the dollar. It saved my house, my fortune, or whatever. The other one, I guess, is gold, because a lot of people were talking into buying gold and listen to the old gold bug scenarios that have been the same ones since the 1970s. I just simply explain, look, gold goes up when the confidence in government collapses, and we're getting close to that. And so you'll probably start to see it rise more sustainable after next year. But it's, you know, it's gold doesn't go up with inflation or you know, it's more of a confidence factor.
Where can people find out more about your books and Armstrong Economics?
Just go to our website, armstrongeconomics.com. We respect everybody's privacy, so you do not have to even register to go on to see anything. We don't sell advertising on there, so you don't have to keep clicking all the ads all the way so you can see what's actually there. It's a public service, and that's the way we try to keep it.
Martin, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's always a pleasure.
My guest has been Martin Armstrong, founder of Armstrong Economics, available online at armstrongeconomics.com. Coming up, Victor Adair, next on This Week in Money.
Introducing Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt 2AM. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Victor Adair. Recently retired from nearly 50 years of being in the brokerage business in British Columbia, he's speaking to us from beautiful Parksville on Vancouver Island. Welcome back to the show, Victor.
Jim, thanks for having me back.
Victor, stock markets, interest rates, currencies, and commodities have all been very volatile lately. Before we talk about the different markets, what's your big picture view right now?
Well, you're absolutely right about the volatility. It has been amazing across different asset classes. But yeah, the big picture, I mean, really, it continues to be all about the Fed. You know, a year ago, around about now, the Fed was still talking about inflation being transitory, and I don't think they were stupid. They just, you know, that's what they saw. And they've been proven since then that they were, well, call it horribly wrong. And to make up for it, they have been very aggressive in raising interest rates and in what we would call tightening monetary policy. And these days, not only are they raising interest rates, but they're also selling some of the billions and billions of dollars worth of securities that they bought in the markets back, you know, during the COVID period and all that sort of thing, where they were doing their bit along with the government to stimulate the economy. Anyway, the Fed has been very aggressive. I think the Fed has been more aggressive, or has continued to be at a level of aggressiveness that was higher than virtually anybody would have expected several months ago. And we're kind of, the big question, I think, these days is, are we getting near to the point where the Fed would either pause or pivot, you know, go the other way? And certainly so far, you know, the answer is no. However, we have to kind of imagine what might cause that. And I think the Fed, for instance, we've got the economy, the real economy looks like, if you just look at employment, like it's doing fine. We're at about a 3.5% level of unemployment, which is a 50-year low. There are, you know, about 4 million new jobs, I think, added in the American economy this year. So, in that sense, you know, there's not a slowdown in the economy. Let me maybe back up and say what the Fed is trying to do in order to get inflation down, which they want inflation down, is they're trying to bring it down by destroying demand in the economy. And one of the ways to do that, I guess, if you put prices up, people stop buying stuff, you know, and that would, and that's just horribly crude of me to say it that way, but that's kind of what's going on. So far, I mean, we're seeing consumer sentiment is getting hurt. Some aspects of the market certainly getting hurt. But nobody's crying uncle yet, although people are complaining like crazy about higher gasoline prices, and that'll be an election issue. The midterms are coming up in just another couple of weeks. And this level of inflation could well see the Democrats lose control of the House and maybe the Senate as well. But to get to it, there's another thing which could cause the Fed to pause or pivot. And that would be that something breaks, to use that term, such as, for instance, happened in the United Kingdom here in the last 2 weeks, where the sharply rising interest rates over there, and they've got about a 10% CPI inflation, roughly speaking. The new government proposed a budget where they were going to try to, you know, get the economy growing by cutting taxes and spending money and borrowing money to fund those things. The bond market had a hissy fit, and yields on British bonds went to about 5 or just above 5%, which put them on par in terms of what you got to pay with Greece, and maybe look kind of bad for the UK. But the sharp rise in those interest rates caused the pension fund industry in the UK to really have a problem. And I won't go into it all, other than the Bank of England realized that they had a real issue. In other words, something was breaking with the pension fund industry, and they started buying bonds, which is just a 180 degree turn of where they'd been the day before. So, you know, they had a pivot in that sense. So in the U.S. here, and let's say by extension around the world, because the Fed is central banker to the world in a really realistic way, they have been pushing interest rates sharply higher, very aggressively, showing no sign of backing off. And you have to ask yourself, is there something, somebody out there that is about to go under or have a real problem or break? And if the Fed gets wind of that, then we may see the Fed at least pause, if not pivot. So we've got the market has been priced, this is across asset classes, has been priced for a very aggressive Fed, and yet at the same time, everybody that's trading these markets is aware that, you know, just at the snap of somebody's fingers, we could have a reversal and have the Fed, which is just the Fed tightening is the most important thing in the market here, we could have the Fed do a 180, and that would change everything. So that's kind of, I think, where we're at. How that shows up in the market, I think there's a lot less liquidity. The bid-offer spreads are wider. In plain language, people with any sense, you know, are backing away from the market in terms of size and aggressiveness of their trading, just out of prudence. So, yeah, it's a pretty fragile, I guess, would be my tone here. I mean, there's certainly opportunities, but boy, oh boy, you better have your heads up before you get into anything.
Well, the UK pension crisis has resulted in the Chancellor of the Exchequer, their version of the finance minister, resigning.
So, well, yeah, he got fired.
Yeah, he got resigned, as we say in the business.
Yeah, I think the term really is he got thrown under the bus. Okay, I mean, it was his budget that proposed to try to spur the economy to greater growth, that caused the interest rates to go higher, that caused the Bank of England to have to come in and save the day, as it were. So, yeah, somebody had to get thrown under the bus, and so far it was him. I mean, we may see the new Prime Minister also lose her job if there's not enough support throughout the party for her to continue.
Stock markets had a very volatile day on Thursday after the cost of living report showed that consumer inflation in the U.S. was hotter than it's expected. It hit a 50-year high. What do you think caused that incredible volatility?
Yeah, I mean, roughly speaking, let's do it this way. The number came out at 5:30 in the morning, West Coast time. And then the headline number was an 8.2% inflation rate on CPI. So that was certainly at the high end, or maybe even higher than a lot of people that try to forecast these numbers had expected. And in moments, I think we had, for instance, Dow Jones terms, we were off at least 500 points. And then by 6:30, then West Coast time, when the floor sessions opened, markets were a little lower. And then the strangest thing happened, like across asset classes, we had a reversal. But just in the stock market, the Dow rallied, and I'm going to get the number wrong, but let's say to the closest 100 points, it rallied about 1,800 points throughout the floor session on Thursday and into Friday morning. So what? Why? Why did that happen? I think, as I mentioned earlier, that people are on tenterhooks here, thinking that because of this aggressive Fed policy, something could break and the Fed would have to change their tune. I think maybe there was some of that people thought, "Holy mackerel, this is going to trigger something." Then I think there was also positioning was huge here. Given the choppiness of the markets, I think there's a real propensity to book profits when you have a chance. So anybody that was short the market and did well with the break probably said, "You know, I think I'll take the money," and they then became buyers. Whatever we, and some people, of course, are going to, let's call it the conspiracy crowd, may expect that, you know, the plunge protection team was in there buying the market. I don't know. Believe me, I don't pretend I know. I just watch the price action. Whatever, I saw the market started to lift. I actually bought the market. I was using S&P futures. And a couple of hours later, I was astonished at how much the market had moved in my favor this time. And I took profits on my position. It was sort of like a 1,000 points or so, a Dow Jones equivalent. And I think, you know, it was just one of those lack of liquidity, positioning-driven moves, and maybe on a wing and a prayer and a hope that, you know, we finally got to the point where it couldn't get any worse, and we had to rally. Now, historically, in bear markets, and we are in a bear market, you know, we're down over 20% from the highs that we made at the beginning of the year in the broad indices. A lot of individual issuers are down a lot more than that. In bear markets, you get astonishing, breathtaking bear market rallies from time to time, and we certainly saw one on Thursday.
In August 2020, the U.S. 10-year Treasury yield was around 0.5%, which was an all-time low. Now it's over 4%, a 14-year high. What's happening with the bond market, and where does it go from here?
Yeah, the bond market, you're right. We had those all-time lows just over 2 years ago. And since then, bond yields have been rising, and it was a classic case of slowly at first and then quickly. Certainly, the last several months, they've almost been going straight up to, as you say, a 14-year high. The bond market got to those lows 2 years ago, in one part, certainly, because the central bank was buying every bond that wasn't nailed down. So as part of their easy monetary policy, and as they were, in effect, you know, monetizing the fiscal stimulus from the governments, and this was central banks all over the world, by the way, that's when we got to the, I don't know, $20 trillion worth of negative yielding bonds that were outstanding. And now that's reversed. I mean, the Fed is not only raising interest rates, but they are doing quantitative tightening, QT, as we call it, and they are buying billions and billions and billions of dollars out of the market. I should say, they're selling billions and billions of dollars from their warehouse full of bonds, all the bonds that they bought, and then they're starting to put that back into the market again. So we're in an environment where inflation, you know, we just talked about the CPI headline number at 8.2%, and various other inflation metrics are certainly way higher than what the Fed would like to see them. So inflation's high. I mean, if you've got a bond and it's yielding 4%, but inflation is if your bond is yielding 4%, which is what the Treasury is at now, but inflation's at 8%, clearly you're losing money. So the bond market's kind of been like a hot potato. I don't want it here. You take it. And they're trying to find a bottom, as it were, in terms of pricing. It will get to a level where somebody actually wants to step up and buy bond. Now, there's a timing play here. I mean, if you think that the efforts of the central bank by pushing interest rates higher will drive the economy into a recession, and then they will stop doing what they're doing, I mean, bonds are a great way to capitalize on that. You buy bonds now, and you wear diamonds later, as the old expression is. That bonds would rally if, in fact, the Fed gets their wish and, you know, pushes the economy to the point where, you know, we have a recession. So that's it. Now, there's always a bunch of other things. One thing that comes to mind is the bond markets around the world have a relationship with each other. Certainly, we got 0% yield on bonds in Japan, and you got 4% yield on a 10-year bond in the United States. So right there is one of the reasons why the Japanese yen is trading at a 24-year low. You know, the capital is going to move to America and away from yen. In Europe, we're seeing like a pan-European idea about issuing bonds to raise money to give to people and companies to ease the pain of the extraordinarily high energy prices that they have. Well, that sounds good, except you got to say, well, who's going to pay for those bonds? Who's going to buy them? So we got European yields going higher, and if European bond yields are going higher, that's also pushes American yields higher, or call it North American yields higher. In effect, to get right down to the nuts and bolts here, it's like people, it's the old hot potato. Nobody wants to actually own the bonds here, unless, of course, you know, there's one of these something breaks events, and then the Fed reverses course, and then, yeah, you look great for owning bonds. But they are getting, the yields getting pushed higher as inflation seems to be sticky, would be a polite word for it. You know, it's not going down. And who wants to own bonds in this kind of an environment?
Since January of last year, you've been bullish on the U.S. dollar in every one of our monthly interviews, although you sounded close to changing your mind last month. Where do you stand now on the greenback?
Yeah, the U.S. dollar has been almost astonishing, I guess, in the rally that it's had since, I remember we were talking about it, specifically the storming of the Capitol building the first week of January 2021. And I called it a blood in the street moment where, you know, the rest of the world is looking on aghast at what's happening and, you know, the shining light on the hill, the beacon of democracy and all that sort of thing. And that was the low point for the dollar, and it's been rallying. One of the things, maybe the most important thing, and nothing else matters, is that, as I've said so many times, capital comes to America for safety and opportunity. And I'm telling you, safety is what people look for when they're fearful. And nothing drives markets faster than fear. I mean, greed is a distant second. So in the world the way it is now, you could make a list the length of your arm about the things that there are to be fearful of. So there's that. And then, of course, the strong dollar is a secondary effect or whatever, is directly created by the Fed policy. And the more the dollar goes up, in a way, the more it accelerates the rise in the dollar, because people that are short dollars, and that just could be as simple as, you know, somebody that owes a debt in dollars, and they're going to create the income to pay that debt in another currency. You know, so if you've got a mortgage in Poland, and it's priced in U.S. dollars, and you're earning your wages in zlotnies, and, you know, you got a problem. And that's just magnified all over the world. So, last month I was starting to wobble on my view on the U.S. dollar, and it did hit a new 20-year high halfway through last month, or toward the end of last month, and it fell back 4%. It's bounced back a little bit, but it's not back to those highs. I'm still, I got to say, Jim, I'm open to wobbling here on my really bullish view on the U.S. dollar for the same kind of reasons I've just mentioned here with other markets. It's like it's gone so far, so quickly, that if something breaks, now that could be a cause of people being fearful and put a bid into the U.S. dollar. But I think if the currency traders got the idea that the Fed was going to pause or pivot, the U.S. dollar would be sold. So I think we are probably, and you can't tell, because, I mean, the black swan, you know, you don't know it, you don't know exactly what it is that's coming, but you can kind of get a sense in the markets that everybody, all the currency traders are going to be looking over their shoulder just in case. And they'll hit the bid really fast if that event, that something breaks event happens. So we've had a hell of a run in the U.S. dollar. It'll probably continue, you know, trends keep going until the end and all that. But I think that would be the thing that would cause the U.S. dollar to turn, is that thought in people's mind that, okay, we have got to the point of peak Fed aggressiveness, and because markets are always trying to price ahead, if it's not going to get any worse, then you have to go the other way.
Energy markets seem to be more in the news nowadays than ever. The production cuts announced by OPEC Plus last week caused a big rally in West Texas crude, but now oil is falling again this week. Is this just short-term volatility, or is the market starting to price in a possible recession?
Well, it could be. I think OPEC themselves, and this may be a justification for why they cut their production targets, then let me go back and get into that in a moment. One of their justifications was they saw a weakening in demand globally. Now, there are when we say they cut 2 million barrels a day, that wasn't $2 million of production, that was they cut their quotas by 2 million. So let's say, just to make it simple, you know, they had quotas of 12 million barrels a day in total, but they were actually only producing 10.5 because for different reasons different countries couldn't produce to their quotas. You know, the machinery didn't work, or the pipelines were plugged, or God knows what. So cutting the quotas by 2 million didn't mean they were going to actually produce and sell 2 million barrels a day less. So the number maybe not as dramatic as it sounded, but regardless, it certainly created a hissy fit in Washington. Biden was saying he's going to take action against the Saudis and all that sort of thing. I'm sure there are going to be all kinds of back-channel diplomacy or threats going back and forth. Now the interesting thing was that crude oil had hit a high of about $130. And when I say crude, I mean WTI, just after the Russians invaded Ukraine and the initial sanctions were put on Russia. And that $130 number was, I guess, roughly the highest we've seen since the 147 number we saw in, it was about July of 2008. And we came all the way down to $76 or so before the price turned higher. And that $76, that brought us down to the lowest price we've seen since January of this year. And it's interesting that the low day on the WTI was the day the markets discovered that there'd been damage done to the Nord Stream pipes, gas pipes coming from Russia down to Germany. So from there, we had a rally of, I don't know, $17 or something like that. The backup here lately, it might be just a pricing in of a possible recession. I could buy that. But what is really happening is that the short-term volatility in the energy markets and virtually every other market as well. I mean, for instance, we had the wheat price jump about $1 when the Ukrainians blew up the bridge linking Crimea. And the thought there was that we're going to suddenly have a halt to wheat exports out of Ukraine because of that. And, like, everything's interrelated here. We've got this amazing volatility that is creating or causing people to back away from the market, which dampens liquidity, widens bid-offer spreads, which, you know, it kind of becomes a vicious circle. So it's not just in the stock market or the currency markets, but the energy markets, the day-to-day or short-term volatility is wicked as well. So why exactly we're here, you know, with my trading, I try to look at that, but I just have to keep reminding myself that I'm probably, no matter how up-to-date I think I am, I'm reading yesterday's news, and there are things going on in these different markets that you have no idea. And I don't care how informed you are, because, you know, stuff happens. I just look at the price as opposed to trying to know that I'm right about why something's happened.
Gold dropped to a 10-month low last month and has trended lower for several consecutive months. Every time we've talked about gold this year, you've pointed out the negative impact of the strong U.S. dollar and rising interest rates. Is the gold market ever going to turn around?
No, it's done. Obviously, I'm kidding. The gold market has had a tough one. I mean, we made the highs in March on the invasion by the Russians into Ukraine, and it's been all downhill since then. I mean, we're down every month in the last 7 months, and I think it's actually a 30-month low that gold traded to here. When I look at the open interest in the COMEX gold futures markets, I don't know, we're at something like a four-year low, something like that. When I look at the participation in the gold ETF market, and I do look at that, I see that since the spike in buying that happened on the Russian invasion, the ETF market has just been nothing but sellers every month, every week. So what that tells me is, and I look at it this way, people that trade in the COMEX gold futures market are probably more short-term than people that trade in the gold ETF market, maybe longer-term. But let's say those are traders or speculators, investors, whatever you want to call them. What it shows me is that folks in those markets just aren't that interested in being in the market. If they were, we would see higher open interest and we would see net buying on the ETF side. So as the gold price has declined around $400+ from the March highs, people have just gone, I'll find something else to do. This is no fun. I'm buying gold, it's going down, I'm selling it. In my blog last week or the week before, I was making a point that one of the reasons to buy gold is to, you know, try to capture price appreciation. That's why I trade it. But another reason that historically to buy gold is to have some, you know, call it insurance. You have some gold just in case the shit hits the fan everywhere and, you know, you've got something of value, something that you can barter or whatever. So, trading, it seems as though the folks on the COMEX and on the gold ETF market have been driven more by trying to make a buck on catching the positive price move. And since gold's been trading lower, they've lost interest and they're out of it. Will gold ever turn around? Gold will turn around on a dime, as it were, if we get some sort of a shock to the market, like I'm saying, if something breaks, if one of those things comes along, because the U.S. dollar will probably be sold. You're right, I've continually harped on the U.S. dollar being strong and real interest rates surging higher. It's just a toxic environment for gold. But that will change in a heartbeat if we have say, one, some kind of a geopolitical crisis, or two, and maybe this is, I don't know how you weight the chances of these things, if we have the market gets it in its mind that the Fed is either pausing or pivoting, gold will jump.
Millennials and Generation Z in Canada, Zers in the U.S., do not seem to be interested in gold in any manner. Do we have to turn it into some kind of a digital currency to get them to pay attention to it?
Yeah, I hear you on that, and I know I've talked to a bullion dealer, one of the most active bullion dealers in Western Canada, about that. And yeah, there seems to be a generational divide. It seems that the boomers buy gold just to have some. This is physical gold I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And the younger folks just aren't as enamored. And I think it could be just as simple as the boomers remember when gold went crazy in 1979, 1980. And, you know, the Millennials and the Zers weren't even born then, so they don't remember. And that was that experience of gold going from, you know, roughly $40 an ounce to $850 an ounce is seared into the memory of traders of a certain age, and all of the reasons why people got into it then. But yeah, there is a demographic change, but I think the combination of people who want to buy gold for insurance in the common, and people who want to buy it because it's going up, if in fact gold becomes a really sharply rising market, I think the younger folks will definitely get interested as well.
You write a weekly blog at victoradair.ca to review the macro markets you trade. You use a lot of charts to illustrate your ideas. And I like the On My Radar section where you talk about what you'll be watching for the week ahead and the trades you might be making. Can you tell us what's on your radar set when you look at the markets today? Vasily, one ping and one ping only. I know that was sonar, but...
I think, if anything, I'm, like a lot of traders, I think, I'm trying to be ready or be prepared if we have a Fed pause or pivot. I do think the markets are really stressed here. And as we saw on Thursday, where we had a 1,800-point rally in the Dow in just a few hours, I think that kind of gives you a sense as to what could happen if we actually did get a signal from the Fed that they were going to change their tune or, you know, modify the aggressiveness or whatever of their policy. I think that's probably the big thing to be watching for. Now, I think that's a tough one to trade, because you know, you could buy the stock market here and it could continue to go down, and you say, well, if I just got my fingers crossed and I know the Fed's going to change their tune and I'll be proven right, it's tough to stay with a trade like that. And then if the Fed somehow does send a signal out, it'll be really tough to buy it because the markets will react so quickly. But if anything, that's what's really on my radar screen. And instead of trying to puzzle out, say, from a fundamental analysis point of view, when that'll be happening, I'm just going to be looking at price action. So this week, a couple of times, I bought the stock market. I bought it, I think it was Monday or Tuesday, and got nicely ahead on the trade. And then we had the Bank of England chief, Mr. Bailey, the governor, say, you know, you've got 3 days to get this straightened out. Well, all of a sudden, you know, the Dow's down 500 points. And my trades, I fortunately was able to get out of those with some losses and some break-evens. I got into the stock market on Thursday, because of just looking at the price action, I thought this market wants to rally here, and got a good pop on that. I am going into the weekend flat. I don't feel a need to put a trade on here. I can just see there's so much stress in the markets, but it's like I'm lurking, looking for a sign, and I'll be ready to step up, but that will be the key thing that I'm looking for. I think that is just more important. Now, clearly, you know, if China hits Taiwan or something like that, or there's a nuclear weapon used in Eastern Europe, I mean, gee whiz, that just is a whole different ball of wax, and you can't imagine, you know, that sort of thing will happen. But who knows?
Victor, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Jim, I appreciate you having me on. I know I ramble a bit here, but there just seems to be so much going on, so much to try to keep track of, and so much that is important. It's hard to try to say it's, you know, it's just the black cat or the white cat.
We just know there's a lot of cats out there, and sometimes they can scratch you and scratch you bad. My guest has been Victor Adair, recently retired from nearly 50 years of being in the brokerage business in BC. Check out his website, victoradair.ca. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Martin Armstrong, and Victor Adair. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or our guests, you can send them to info@housestreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen.